Welcome to Teleforum, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of practice group Teleforum calls, become a Federalist Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Welcome everyone to the Federalist Society's virtual event. Today we're having a special Courthouse Steps decision webinar on a case decided last week by the U.S. Supreme Court called Van Buren v. United States. I'm Nick Marr, Assistant Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that expressions of opinion on our call today are those of our expert. We're very pleased to be joined this afternoon by Mr. Joseph DeMarco. He's a partner at DeMarco Law, PLLC, and a former assistant U.S. attorney from New York's Southern District. Mr. DeMarco will give some opening remarks covering the case, discussing the ruling and its implications, and then we'll be looking to you, the audience, for questions. So feel free to submit those through the chat function as we go along, or raise your hand when we get to the question and answer portion of the call. And with that, Joe, thanks very much for being with us. I'll give the floor to you.
Thanks very much, Mr. Marr. Really appreciate it. And thank you to everyone at the Federalist Society for supporting this webinar. It's a real pleasure to be with everyone this afternoon virtually, and definitely look forward to seeing many of you and some of you at in-person events when they come up. What I'd like to do today is spend a little bit of time talking about what led up to the Supreme Court's decision, then ultimately what the Supreme Court decided in the Van Buren case, and what are some potential implications going forward as a result of the court's decision. It's actually one of, in my estimation, one of the court's more important decisions in the area of computer crime, computer security, and internet law in the last number of years, and was avidly watched by a number of practitioners in the field of law in which I practice. My area of law is full-time the law of data privacy and security and cybercrime prevention and response. And I do that now in the context of my boutique law firm. Before that, before starting the firm 13 years ago, I was a federal prosecutor in New York. I was an assistant United States attorney, and I ran the cybercrime program there from 1997 until 2007. One of the mainstays that we relied upon in prosecuting criminal cases, and which I still regularly consult in my practice today, is what's known as the Federal Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, which is Title 18, United States Code, Section 1030. Broadly speaking, it's a law which has been around for decades that makes it a crime to engage in improper activities on computers, broadly speaking, connected to the internet, computers whose transmissions cross state lines. And it really is kind of the workhorse of criminal federal hacking prosecutions. And interestingly enough, it also has increasingly been used over the last couple of decades by civil plaintiffs because it contains a civil private right of action. So it not only is a criminal statute, which prosecutors can use to bring hacking cases, but it's also a federally created tort, which allows subject matter jurisdiction in federal district courts for cases where people are the victims of cybercrimes and either, you know, they're hacked into by other people or by other companies. So it's been increasingly a tool that's been used both obviously on the criminal side as cybercrime has exploded, but also on the civil side as civil litigation between companies in this area has also increased, which is one reason why this decision was so watched by a number of people in that ecosystem. For many years, the question of exactly what the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act covered was debated among the district courts and among the circuit courts. There was obviously debate as to, you know, what a covered computer was under the law. That's, you know, not the subject of today's discussion, or how to calculate damages under the statute. But one of the main areas of contention was whether or not the law applied exclusively to outsiders, people who had no permission being on a computer system or no permission to have access to a certain file, or whether the law also applied to people who had permission, broadly speaking, to be on a computer system or had permission to access a computer file, but use that permission for an improper motive or an improper purpose. The statute, broadly speaking, makes it a crime or a tort to engage in unauthorized access to a protected computer, again, any computer really connected to the internet, or to exceed your authorized access to that computer. And so what the courts have been wrestling with really for a couple of decades now is, what does it mean to access a computer without authorization, or to exceed your authorized access to a computer? Now, the statute contains a definition for what it means to exceed authorized access, which is the facts of the case, which we'll get into in a moment. But unfortunately, it's not terribly helpful. It's a little circular. Exceeds unauthorized access means, quote, to access a computer with authorization and to use such access to obtain information in the computer that the accessor is not entitled so to obtain. And there was a lot of discussion and debate in the court's opinions on what that last clause means. But broadly speaking, the question is, and the question before the court was, whether or not the statute applies both to outsiders who hack into a system or have no permission being on a file or have access to a file, even though they have permission to be on a system, or whether it applies both, broadly speaking, to insiders as well. People who have permission, a username, a password, credentials to an account, permission set to a specific file, but use that permission for manifestly improper purposes. The case, these situations come up all the time. Interestingly enough, two of the leading cases, including this one, involve corrupt police officials, but they also involve computer hackers. Many years ago, about 10 years ago now, there was a case prosecuted by my old office, the Southern District of New York, against a computer, a computer hacker named Sergei Alenikov, who worked at Goldman Sachs and used his privileged access and permission to Goldman Sachs' computer systems to steal code that company used in their high-frequency trading operation. The government indicted him for violations not only of the Federal Theft of Trade Secret Act, the Federal Interstate Transportation of Stolen Property Act, but also a violation of 1030, because what he did was he was on the system, which he had credentials to, and he used that system to, and his permissions to that system, to take Goldman Sachs's trade secrets and email them to himself at a personal email that controlled that he account. The court dismissed that case prior to trial, dismissed that count, I should say, finding that because he had access to be on the Goldman Sachs system and access to those files, he could not be prosecuted under 1030. A few years later, another case came along, also in the Southern District, involving a corrupt police official, the case of Gilberto Valle, who was a New York City police officer who spent a lot of time in what he claimed were fantasy chat rooms, talking about plans that he had to abduct people and to create all sorts of mayhem as part of, he argued, this kind of fantasy role playing that he was engaged with other people that he met online, and as part of doing what he was doing, he used his privileged access to New York City law enforcement databases to find out personal information about some of the people who he was, in his view, fantasizing about, abducting and killing. The government obviously did not believe that those were fantasies. They charged him with solicitation to murder and other crimes, as well as a 1030 offense. He was convicted, and the case went up to the Second Circuit Court of Appeals. And the Second Circuit ruled that because he had permission to be on the system, the New York City law enforcement database systems that he had access to, even though he was using those permissions, not part of his job, and in obviously flagrant violation of his job duties, because he had permission to be on those systems, he could not be prosecuted under 1030. It was a 2-1 divided panel opinion. So that was kind of the rule in the Second Circuit, but other circuits had different rules as well. In some circuits, if someone was violating contractual employment terms and conditions, courts would find that they were in violation of their authorization. In other cases, courts held that where corrupt insiders, for example, before they left, were downloading proprietary confidential information to use in their next job, they could be held accountable for engaging in unauthorized computer access because they were doing that either in violation of contractual terms that they had agreed to as part of their employment, or because they had agreed to either take on fiduciary duties or the law imposed upon them fiduciary duties not to act in contravention of their employment's interests. So there were these two kind of competing lines of cases, slight majority, what I would call the Second Circuit rule, a rule ultimately adopted, as we'll get to in a moment, by the Supreme Court, a slight minority of cases going the other way. As you might imagine, many of them were criminal cases involving corrupt insiders, people who worked, let's say, at the Social Security Administration, who were stealing IDs to sell to identity thieves, people who were engaged in theft of trade secrets and selling information to competitors, people who were on systems destroying data that they had access to. These were, again, the types of cases that were prosecuted. So along comes the case of United States versus Van Buren. Van Buren was a Georgia state police official who, I won't get into the facts, and they, you know, the court lays them out pretty clearly, in exchange for a bribe of $5,000, used his access to Georgia state law enforcement databases to look up information that someone else was interested in to try and find out if that person whose information was in the database was cooperating with law enforcement. Obviously, something completely improper for that police official to do. The FBI got wind of it. They engaged in an undercover operation. They caught him. He was prosecuted. His case went up on appeal to the 11th Circuit, which followed the what I would call the corrupt insider rule as opposed to the Second Circuit rule, and his conviction was affirmed. Off the case goes to the Supreme Court. Now, I should pause for a moment to say that, you know, 1030 makes it a crime to do a number of things without authorization. It makes it a crime to obtain information from computer databases without authorization. That's what Van Buren was accused of doing. It also makes it a crime to engage in computer damage, harming data that's on computers without authorization. It also makes it a crime to engage in access to computers without authorization or in excess of authority to commit further crimes or torts. What we're talking about in the Van Buren case was obtaining information from a protected computer. So the court heard arguments on both sides. There were a slew of amicus briefs filed on both sides. We were privileged to represent in support of the government two entities. One was the Federal Law Enforcement Officers Association, which is a fraternal organization of federal police officers and federal special agents, FBI agents, postal inspectors, Secret Service agents, and the like. The other entity we were engaged by to file an amicus brief in support of the government was the Managed Funds Association, which is a trade association of the alternative investment industry. Obviously, two very, very different groups. One, obviously, keen on making sure that law enforcement databases were properly secured from potentially corrupt insider misuse of those databases. The other, obviously, very much concerned about the enormous amount of money that goes into creating intellectual property used by the industry and the harms that could come if that property is subject to theft without adequate recourse, either in federal criminal or federal statutory law. Our briefs are on SCOTUS blog, and obviously, you know, if anyone wants a copy, I'm happy to send them to them individually. So what were the arguments in the Supreme Court? Well, in a nutshell, it really boiled down to this. The government said, look, what Van Buren did in no way, shape, or form can have been said to have been authorized. It clearly was in excess of authorized activity. He had permission to be on those Georgia state law enforcement databases. He had a username, he had credentials, whatever it was that gave him access to those databases. He had permission to be on those databases, had permission to be on those files, but in no way, shape, or form, under any kind of common sense, plain meaning, textualist sense of the term, could you say that his authorization was, that his activities were authorized. Clearly, they were unauthorized. The other side, the defendant, Van Buren, said, not so fast. Let's look at the text of the statute. The text of the statute says that you can only be accused of engaging in excess of authority if you obtain the information in a way that you are not entitled so to obtain it. And the argument that the defense posited was that he was so obtained, he could so obtain that information by virtue of having a username and a password authorization to obtain that information. And so when it comes to obtaining the information that he obtained in that way, since he was authorized to obtain it in that way, he was authorized to obtain it. And having been authorized to obtain it, the fact that he may have breached, you know, contractual or fiduciary or other obligations not to use it in that sense was not really germane to the question. The court ruled 6-3 in Van Buren's favor. The majority opinion was written by Justice Barrett, joined by Justices Breyer, Sotomayor, Kagan, Gorsuch, and Kavanaugh. The dissent was written by Justice Thomas, joined by Justices Roberts and Alito. Notably, both the majority and the dissent really took, I would say, a plain meaning textualist approach to the question. They just came out in different ways. What the court basically, the majority basically adopted was Van Buren's position, which it described as kind of the gates up, gates down position, which is to say that under Van Buren's position, which is a code-based interpretation of how the statute should be interpreted, if you have access to the computer, if you have access to the file in question, the gate is up. If the gate is up, even if you violated fiduciary duties or acted improperly, if you have an improper motive, it doesn't matter, the gate is up. No computer hacking, no unauthorized access, no activity in excess of authorization. On the other hand, if as a matter of technology, code, that is, the gate is down, the person does not have permission to be on the system as a matter of technology, does not have permission to access the file as a matter of code or technology, the gate is down, and assuming the other elements of the statute are met, the person could be prosecuted or sued civilly under 1030G, the civil prong of the statute. What's interesting is a number of the amicus briefs touched on concerns that if the court were to side with the defense, there could be a number of kind of nonsensical results. For example, defense and Amici on the other side said if the court ruled in favor of the government, anyone who went on a dating website and lied about their age or weight because they were violating the terms laid down by the dating website could arguably be held in violation of the statute because it's not authorized. You're not authorized to lie about your height and weight. Most dating websites say you must provide accurate information on that. The court did pick up on that, although they didn't go all that far with that. They just kind of noted that that was a concern and that it was a valid, potentially valid concern. The court also spent a little bit of time talking about whether or not, the government's charging decisions and prosecutorial discretion could be used to weed out cases where people were engaging in kind of otherwise non-blameworthy conduct, which could violate the terms of use of, again, let's say a social media website or terms laid down by their employer. And the court, was concerned about that. They were concerned about the fact that even though, as stated by the government in its briefs, the DOJ has a policy against bringing those types of cases, there was no, at least as to the unauthorized access portion of the statute, no statutory prohibition against those kind of cases were the court to adopt the government's position. The dissent just kind of said, look, we should look at this from a very plain meaning sense of the view. If you think of a computer as a piece of property, or the intellectual property on it as, property, what's going on in terms of someone who abuses their permissions and acts for an improper motive is very clear. What they're doing is wrong. And that's kind of where, the debate laid. There are a couple of, one interesting thing I thought was noteworthy about the court's decision, and then I'll talk a little bit about what I think the implications are, is footnote 8 of the opinion. And if you kind of just take anything away from the court's opinion, which again, that both sides, the dissent and the majorities were very well written and very well reasoned, they just came out differently on the question, it's footnote 8. After talking about the kind of this gates up, gate down, code-based approach that the court was going to ultimately adopt, the court said the following, for present purposes, we need not address whether this inquiry turns only on technological or code-based limitations on access, or instead only looks to limits contained in contracts or policies. So what's interesting is the court, at the same time it was saying it was adopting a code-based approach as distinct from, let's say, a contract-based approach or a norms-based approach, which is another approach you could take to determining what's authorized versus unauthorized. At the same time that it was saying we're taking a code-based approach, the gate is either open or closed, the person either has technological access to the account or the computer or they don't, it kind of introduced the possibility that at least in the contractual setting, if there are contractual provisions in place prohibiting the conduct in question, that at least seems to be on the table for potential liability criminally or civilly under the statute. And Justice Thomas, picked up on that in his dissent and said, The court talks about nonsensical results if the government's view is adopted, but how much sense does it make sense if you adopt a contract-based approach and allow an employer who, let's say, as a matter of contract, prohibits someone from playing games on the company computer, you allow that employment contract term to govern what is or is not unauthorized conduct? Isn't that also arbitrary? Can't that also lead to unfair results? So kind of, again, a debate about whether or not other things other than code should come into play. The court didn't really address norms. That's kind of another theory under which authorization can or cannot be inferred. And typically norms, you know, relate to fiduciary duties and just sort of common, you know, common understandings of what is and is not permitted online. Didn't really talk about a norms-based approach. So I think that in terms of the implications going forward and what's going to happen going forward is I would expect to see probably more civil litigation than criminal litigation coming out of this, you know, footnote number 8 and the potential ability of people to bring lawsuits where employees or others have specifically contractually in an arm's length non-adhesion contract scenario agreed not to do certain things on or with the computers, and then they do those things on or with the computers. I expect to see some, you know, some litigation over that. I also think, and this was kind of in our briefs, you know, we pointed out the risks inherent in adopting the defendant's position. You know, if regardless of whether you're, you know, a government agency or a law enforcement agency seeking to protect confidential information, or whether you're a financial services company or some other producer of intellectual property looking to protect IP and have the ability to bring a 1030 civil lawsuit or referral to criminal prosecutors in the event that there's a misuse of data on the systems, I think it's now incumbent upon those organizations to do a number of things. In addition, potentially to, you know, modifying their contractual terms of service along the lines perhaps suggested by Justice Barrett in footnote number 8. And one of those things is to police permissions. Because right now, if you take a very, you know, robust view of the majority's opinion and you don't think you're going to have much comfort in any contractual prohibitions, the only thing separating, you know, you from having a 1030 potential criminal referral as an owner of IP or a civil cause of action under 1030 is whether or not an employee had permission to be on a file or permission to be on the system. So I, you know, definitely encourage everyone out there that has computers that their organization is, you know, responsible for running to double down on policing permissions. Because the bottom line is if someone has a username and an account on your system, has access to a file, it's going to be very hard to bring a 1030 case. Now, it doesn't mean you can't bring a theft of trade secret case. Doesn't mean you can't bring an interstate transportation of stolen property case, although those are difficult as well. Doesn't mean you might may not have a remedy under state computer hacking laws, which in some cases are a little bit broader, although states typically have less resources to bring those cases criminally. But it does mean that you really need to do think about permission access control assurance. I also think it's important for companies to audit permissions, audit what rights people have on files, whether it's to copy, move, modify, print, whatever, and to really be on top of that. Not a bad idea from a data hygiene and data permissioning point of view anyway, but it just becomes incredibly more important now. I do think it also has the potential, the ruling has the potential, again, unless there's some, you know, development along the lines of footnote number 8, to reduce collaboration. I mean, a lot of times organizations will give broad permissions to broad numbers of people to do broad types of things so that people have access to data and can do their jobs. They don't have to stop, pause, and go to, you know, go to a colleague or a supervisor to gain permission to be in a file. So I think that, you know, it has the potential, depending on how companies and organizations react, of potentially reducing collaboration, reducing creativity, and reducing cooperation among people who have, broadly speaking, permissions to be on a computer system. And then finally, you know, in terms of absurd results, well, you know, I think one thing about the case is, you know, both sides could point to results which just don't really make sense if the other side's view is adopted. And I think, you know, Justice Barrett did that on the one side and Justice Thomas did that on the other side. I'll just leave you with a couple and I'm happy to take questions. This is just kind of, you know, from our brief, you know, we raised the possibility of, you know, what would happen if the defendant's view of the statute was adopted. And these are three cases which I think, you know, really could now pertain. This is a page 25 of our MFA brief. So case one, the firm's IT department inadvertently changes defendant's technical permissions a day too early. So a day before the person is, let's say, transferred from one department inside of a company to another, a day too early, their technical permissions are changed. In order to complete her assigned tasks, the employee uses a coworker's credentials to access the required confidential files. Well, under the majority's rule, since the defendant lacked technical access, gate down, their action is unauthorized. We argued in favor of a holistic approach, looking at, holistically speaking, whether under a totality of circumstances test, the conduct could be held to be authorized or not. And in our view, you know, if you looked at the totality of circumstances, that would not be unauthorized. But in a gates up, gates down world, gates down, conduct unauthorized, potential 1030, criminal liability, potential 1030, civil liability. Along the same lines, case two. The defendant's transfer occurs midweek, but due to the manner in which the firm's IT department operates, his former permissions will not be revoked until the end of the week. Defendant's supervisor specifically reminds him that, having transferred out of the department, he has no longer permission to access the departmental's confidential systems and data and should refrain from doing so. The defendant agrees to this limitation, which aligns with his employment agreement. Later that day, the defendant accesses the files of his former department and maliciously deletes them. Because his credentials were still valid, his actions for purposes of the CFAA are, ironically, authorized. The gate was up. Case three. Due to a configuration error, the transfer defendant is inadvertently given access to the firm's HR system. Although unrelated to his job and knowing he should not do so, he takes the opportunity to read the confidential files of several of his coworkers and alters data in those files. Because of the configuration error, his spying and his alteration of the data is considered authorized activity. I mean, these things do happen. There are configuration all the time, errors all the time. You know, it's very hard in a large organization to police permissions. So I would just leave you with those possibilities. And you know, I think the challenge for all of us that, you know, as I do represent organizations committed to protecting the data on those systems, the challenge is in light of the gates up, gates down ruling and in the absence of any development in the case law along the lines of footnote eight, the question is, where do we go from here? To be determined. So, Mr. Marr, I'll turn it back to you, and I'm happy to take some questions. Thank you again for having me today.
Great. Thanks, Joe. So we'll take some questions now. So we have a question here that came up through the question and answer chat. Joe, in your view, does the holding place an increased burden on the private sector to police cases of unauthorized access?
It does. It requires, I think, increased vigilance as to who has access to your core IP, who has access to employee data, who has access to customer data. I would definitely take all those things into account. Number two, I would try at least to help develop the case law under footnote eight and put in place specific contractual prohibitions against certain forms of misuse, the forms of misuse you're most concerned about. And three, I would also try and analyze what other remedies you have, perhaps under state law, hacking law, or unfair competition law, so that when that day comes, I mean, I get a lot of calls from clients who have IP stolen from them by insiders. You know, you don't have to have the conversation with me, you know, about, well, you know, you don't really have many options. I mean, I get a lot of those calls from companies that have had corrupt insiders do things they shouldn't do. And, you know, we look everywhere to see where our potential remedies are. Sometimes, you know, we had courts of appeals and jurisdictions where we could bring a 1030 case or do a 1030 referral. Now we don't, so we have to look elsewhere sometimes to state law. So I think the answer to the question is yes.
Okay, we've got a question that came through email. You can also submit them via email at pg@fed-stock.org, but that's probably easier right now live to go through the chat here. But this one says, what should employers do to maximize their ability to pursue claims under CFAA? Key employees limited to accessing only the silo they need to work. If they access info outside that silo, the employee is liable.
Yeah, I think one thing I should add too is monitoring. You know, and obviously there are limits and rules and laws and best practices related to employee monitoring. It has to be done the correct way. It cannot be creepy or privacy invasive. But I think the earlier a company or organization detects potential misuse, the more remedies it has at its disposal, for sure.
So just another reminder, if you'd like to ask a question, either raise your hand or submit through chat. We don't have any right now. I've got one to ask. How does the opinion and the breakdown of the justices, an interesting one, how does it compare track with your expectations coming out of oral argument?
So, you know, I having listened to oral argument, I knew it was an uphill battle, for the government, and for the sides that we filed our amicus briefs on. I was a little wondering about where Justice Alito would come down, because, you know, the comment from oral argument that stuck with me was, you know, his comment towards the end, which is, you know, he said, "I find the briefs spectacularly unhelpful in deciding this issue," or so words to that effect. So I kind of thought he could go either way. Then again, obviously, I'm not surprised ultimately. I think, again, both sides took a very straightforward approach. What is the text of the statute? How do we get at what these words mean? When the statute says that someone is not entitled so to obtain something, it's kind of a quirky way of saying something, right? What does the "so" refer to? You have to grapple with that. I mean, the whole case really did kind of come down to what "so" referred to, which is not usual. You know, usually there are more words in play than that. So I guess I wasn't surprised at the outcome. Somewhat surprised at the breakdown. Another possibility, too, that I think is worth mentioning is the potential for congressional reform. You know, a few years ago, I believe it was the Second Circuit, I don't think it was the Supreme Court, made a key ruling in the Economic Espionage Act case, which made it much harder for companies to bring trade secret referrals, either criminally or civilly. Within 6 months, Congress amended the statute to fix the gap identified by the court. It wouldn't surprise me here if there's, you know, requests, from IP producers, from the government, from anyone really that owns computers and cares about the data on those computers, to reform the statute. And I will say, interestingly enough, I think one thing that's interesting, if you look through the amicus briefs, in this case, Epic and EFF were on different sides. So it's not often that these two very, you know, very well-known online privacy civil liberties groups are on different sides of a case. But the way it all netted out, EFF was on one side and Epic was on the other. So, and if you're going to read any of the amicus briefs in the case, other than the ones we filed, I would say those are the ones to read, because they also highlight, you know, the question of, you know, how is it best to police potential government misconduct as it relates to data that the government collects. I mean, remember, Van Buren was a corrupt police official. Gilberto Valle was a corrupt police official. There are other cases where 1030 prosecutions are brought against corrupt government insiders who have access to data that the government has collected on citizens. And even though they have technical permission, gates up, to be on those systems, they're using that access for flagrantly improper purposes. So I think that's kind of what one of those groups picked up on. The other group picked up on the other point, which is, you know, let's not make criminals out of people who lie about their height and weight on dating websites. So it's a fascinating case.
Well, seeing no other questions, Mr. DeMarco, I'll give you the chance for any closing remarks you might have, or we'll close out a bit early this afternoon.
Great. Well, thank you. Again, for those of you that follow this stuff, I'd say watch the appellate litigation, watch the news blogs, talk to people who might be, you know, hearing what companies and organizations are doing in light of this. We'll obviously be providing our own advice to our clients on this. I've given you kind of a high level overview of what that might be. And do expect further litigation, because, you know, dollars to donuts, the civil litigants that want to get into federal court on 1030G, which again gives you subject matter jurisdiction, don't have to worry about diversity, gets you statutory damages, gets you all the benefits of being in federal court, they're going to try and use footnote 8. So I would say that's where you want to watch the case law develop. Thank you very much, and happy to field any questions. Obviously, that people reach out to me directly. I'm happy to answer any questions people might have.
Very well. Thanks very much for being with us, Mr. DeMarco. Benefit of your time and valuable expertise this afternoon. Of course, your audience for calling in for your good questions. As a reminder, we welcome your feedback by email at info@fed-soc.org. So anything about this program or any others. Also, keep an eye on your email on our website for announcements about upcoming events like this one and Supreme Court coverage as we get towards the end of the term here. So with that, thanks very much for being with us. And until next time, we're adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Teleform, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. For more information about the Federalist Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federalist Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.